What I'd like to see more of in Sydney is a lot more murals and street art, because I think that just kind of makes Sydney a lot more colourful place.
I would like to see Sydney transport change because it's ridiculous, expensive and a hassle.
The change I want to see most in Sydney is for accommodation to become more affordable, especially for students.
What needs to change in Sydney is that we need to have more support for young comedians, because there's no training ground, there's no groups or anything. And it'd be really nice if we had like little comedy troupes and stuff. You could go see them, have a drink, you know, have a steak, have a beer, and then be nice to laugh. There's not enough laughter. That needs to change.
Hello and welcome to All the Best. My name's Eliza Salos, here this morning to bring you these stories from Sydney, all of them looking at something we experience pretty regularly, whether we like it or not, and that's change. We'll be exploring the change that happens in the life of a band, the change that near disaster can bring to your life, and change that you might aspire to have in your life. At the top of the show, we asked you, what do you think should change in Sydney? You can text us on 0409 945 945. Send us a tweet at _allthebest. We'll be returning to that question throughout the show. What do you think should change in Sydney? 0409 945 945 to let us know. You are listening to All the Best on FBI 94.5, and life does change slowly. You don't always notice the phases until you look back. Margaret, Jeanvied, and Shahrazad are grandmother, mother, and daughter, three generations of the same family. In our first story today, each at different stages in their life. Welcome us in.
I'm Margaret. Shahrazad.
Jeanvied Douglas. I get called JV Douglas by most people because I have a bit of an unusual name.
Who's your mum?
My mum was Edna. My mum is Margaret.
My mum is Jeanvied Douglas.
Do you have any children?
I have three children. One I gave up for adoption because the relationship with her father was not going to work out. I was planning on studying in Scotland, and so to continue with my studies, I had the baby adopted in England. But we're now in contact. We see one another about every 2 years. She lives in New Zealand. I have two kids. I have a little girl who's 8, Shahrazad, and I have a little boy who's 4, Galileo.
No, I'm only 8 years old.
Did you shock your parents?
I don't think I ever shocked my parents.
Did you try?
No, I didn't try. I had a very strict upbringing. My father was incredibly strict. I didn't want to get belted, so I behaved myself. Oh, it was impossible for me to shock my parents when I was a kid. It was impossible. I have two older brothers and an older sister, half brothers and sisters, and they were real ratbags when they were adolescents. And by the time I came along, everything that could possibly have been done by a wayward adolescent had been done. And I couldn't do anything to shock her. I honestly couldn't.
No, I can never shock my parents.
Have you been travelling?
Well, firstly, I did my nursing training in Sydney, and I did my midwifery in Canberra. Then I came back to Sydney because my father was ill, and got a job working with intellectually disabled children. And I thought, I know nothing about this field of nursing. So I asked a few questions, and I was told Denmark and Holland were the best, but the language was too hard to learn to do the course there. So I chose Scotland, where I could do the course in 14 months. I spent some time in London before I went to Scotland, fell madly in love in London. I left him behind and I went to work in Denmark. It was just so far ahead of what we were doing in Australia for people with intellectual disabilities. I think I learnt more there than I did in the training course in Scotland.
South America, mainly. I go to different parts of Asia for work occasionally, but I lived for a year in Costa Rica in Central America and during high school, and then for a year in Mexico during university. Costa Rica, going to live in Costa Rica when I was 14 changed me radically, because I was in a very formative age as well. And it changed me in a way that, not in a superficial way, it changed me in so far as I began to understand that cultures, the way we behave within cultures, are based on a series of arbitrary assumptions that don't really have anything to do with any kind of logic or reason.
I've been to the south of Australia, and I've been to Argentina when I was a little baby.
I wanted to do medicine. I wanted to be a doctor.
I can't remember actually wanting to do anything. I just kind of ended up. I was at university to learn and to learn how to learn. Now I'm a journalist at BRW magazine. I love journalism. It's like never having left university.
So I would like to be a surgeon to help people, but I think that's a bit difficult to do.
Do you think the world has gotten more dangerous in your lifetime?
I think it's probably safer because we've got better communication and we've got a better transportation. We've always had the thugs, but you can stay away from those. I never had any trouble with people assaulting me or attacking me. I might have been lucky.
Oh, it's definitely got safer. Like more people have more to eat, more people are in less danger of violence. Certainly Australia is a safer place than it was because we've got less violence on the streets, we've got less chemicals in the water, we've got less pollution in the air. Those sorts of things are very important, but I think there are now less but more intense cases of violence.
It's getting scary. I think it's becoming fun because there's all these new stuff coming out, but I still think we're polluting a little bit of the earth.
What's your favourite book?
Gone with the Wind.
Probably In the Skin of a Lion.
My favourite book, as I told you, is Harry Potter and Pippi Longstockings.
What's your most important relationship?
Oh, my relationship with my children.
Oh, gosh. I couldn't. The part where I give is to my children. That's the most important relationship in terms of where I need to give unto others. In order to do that, I need a very strong relationship with my husband. We don't exist as separate entities. You know, we have a whole family unit.
My friends and my mum and dad and my little brother.
Have you ever fallen in love?
Oh, I fell in love in England. I fell in love with an American when I was working in England. We wrote to one another for several years.
Oh, Christ, yeah. I'm a shocker. I never fall out of love either, which is why I have such terrible relationships. But yes, I've definitely been in love.
No.
I didn't really want to get married, I don't think. I was talking to a psychiatrist that I really valued, that I'd worked with, and she said it's really tough for kids when their parents aren't married. And that was the turning point. It didn't make any difference to me whether I was or I wasn't, but I thought for the sake of my kids, I wanted to be married.
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, I had a wedding planned before I had a boyfriend. I always wanted just a big fun party, that's all. Nothing too flash, just fun.
Do you think you'll get married one day?
Yes, of course.
Are you looking forward to it?
I don't want to say that.
Are you happy?
Yes, I am. I would like a man in my life, but I'm happy. I guess I'm a normal heterosexual female. And I did divorce my husband because of his alcohol, but, you know, I miss having that male companionship.
Yes, yes, I'm extremely happy. I'm in this crazy, crazy situation where I love my husband, even if he doesn't like my mushroom soup. I love my kids. I love my job. I don't seem to have these issues that a lot of working mums have with allocating their time and being torn between their job that they love and their kids that they love. So it just kind of all falls together.
Well, I'm happy now because I've got my grandma over and some of my mummy's friends. We're all having fun having chocolate mousse. But I wasn't so happy with mushroom soup for lunch.
Shahrazad, who, with her mum, Jean Vida, and her grandma, Margaret, were talking with Sasha Rosen. You're listening to All the Best on FBI 94.5. If you're having trouble hearing us on your FM dial at 94.5, you can find us crystal clear over at fbiradio.com, or if you've got a digital radio, just at FBI Radio. We are having some issues with the transmitter, but we promise to get them sorted out super quick. Now, you are listening to All the Best. This morning, we are exploring that one thing that, no matter how hard you fight it, you can't resist. We're looking at change. Banshee on FBI 94.5, where we're looking at the theme of change. The track we did here was Changes. Now, we're asking you throughout today's program what you would like, what you think should change in Sydney. You can let us know by sending us a text, 0409 945 945. You can also tweet at us, FBI Radio. Now, last night, Mike Williams was walking down Oxford Street and needed to pick up some batteries. He walked into a convenience store, struck up a conversation with Mick, the guy behind the counter. They started talking about Oxford Street, then FBI, and then got talking about change. Mick began to tell the story of his childhood dream, and now he's coming to terms with the fact he might not be able to achieve it. This is Mick's story.
My name is Mick Elmas. I am 28 years old. I am standing in a tobacconist in Oxford Street. I like to be happy, like just smiling for customer.
You're a good tobacconist.
Oxford Street, like the big change I've noticed here, it was like 3 years ago, it was more busy than nowadays.
Mick is naturally a curious guy.
When I come here, I work with in this shop, like I've met a lot of people from different culture, from different countries. Also, I've got another job like a few weeks ago, and I work with as a sales representative as well as a part-time. When I had that job, I become like more ambitious to communicate with different people from different culture, from different age, from different cities.
Mick wants to be a journalist, and he reckons this new sales job he's got has really helped him grow.
I was a little bit shy, maybe, but now I feel like more comfortable now talking to people and like make a big change in my life as a person.
What interests you about being a journalist?
Journalist. My uncle, he was working as a producer and in a company, and I like him too much. Like he was like my stepdad.
Like your idol.
My dad, he passed away. Like he walked after me and, you know, support me emotionally, physically, everything, like in money, financially, everything. And because I like him, I when I was a little, I was go with him for a job, and I see the cameras and, you know, famous people, you know, like, and I was that ambitious, like to work as journalist or work with anything with mass media. Yeah, but for me, like, I couldn't have the chance because it was like financially, because if I want to study like journalist, was a bit expensive for me.
Despite this, Mick still wants to be a journalist, but he really has no idea how he could do it. He's a bit confused. Mick's at a bit of a crossroads in his life. He's standing on the edge of change.
I still have the ambitious like to work with as a journalist or something, because I want to show the right thing. I want to stand for the right things, and there is a lot of people, they are silent. They can't communicate either, or they can talk about their problem or for some reason. I want to talk for them, in behalf of them.
So really, you want to be a journalist so you can make change?
I think it's gonna make a big change for me. For me, like your happiness, being happy to help others.
Later on, Mick is realistic with me about his future.
I'm now confused if I go for it or not. Now, like I have a lot of things like thinking a lot of things I have to do in my life. For example, I've been like working like something casual things. I think now like I need a proper job, you know. I want something like real. But the main thing for me, like, I think is financially. I can't afford, like, to go study again and have, like, yeah. This is the main obstructing thing for me. To be honest with you, at the moment I have no ideas, but in the future, like, I'm planning to do something. Maybe I'm going to work hard, save some money, apply for any job can relate me to be, like, a journalist, anything with mass media, and, like, go step by step, maybe.
That was Mick Elmes, a tobacconist on Oxford Street, telling All the Best about changes in his life and his dream to become a journalist. After the interview, Mick and producer Mike were standing around chatting when someone walked in to buy some smokes. Mick asked if he could borrow the recorder to ask the customer some questions. He grabbed the recorder and wasn't all that bad. We're very proud to introduce this next piece. Mick Elmes filed this story for All the Best.
Do you mind if we make a little interview with you? Like, for 2 minutes?
Yeah, I can do 2 minutes.
Wait, you're done. You can do the interview.
Okay, I'm giving you the recorder.
What's your name?
Sam.
Sam, how are you, Sam?
I'm good.
We are doing, like, interview. Like, what's the biggest change in your life?
The big change in my life?
Yeah.
I recently moved back to Sydney after being away for 15 years.
Oh, really? Yeah. Where you have been?
I've been in Europe, living over there for a while, and then I thought I'd come back to Sydney, so here I am.
So, like, when you come back from overseas, have you noticed any change?
Some changes. I think Sydney's grown up a little bit. It's become more sort of trendy, and, you know, there's more places to go out and have dinner and go to see bands or, you know, go to drink. But in some other ways, like transport, it's done nothing.
What about you, about yourself? Like, have you noticed that there have a big change in your life?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, the usual changes that you go through when you go from being in your 20s to being in your 30s, really.
I'll ask you about Oxford Street now. Then.
Yeah.
What's the big change in Oxford Street between, the, like, 16 years ago and now? What you have noticed?
I think it's a lot more self-assured. Like, people now know, you know, and internationally it's known as sort of, like, you know, the gay capital of the Southern Hemisphere, I think. So, you know, I think people are more confident with that. And it's like, well, this is our patch. And, you know, if you want to come here, you got to enjoy what we do.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. And you welcome to Aussieland.
No worries.
And enjoy your time and have a beautiful night.
I will. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Aussieland.
Well, yeah, come back anytime. Yeah.
Bye bye. See you.
See you later. That's good, man. It's good. You can be a journalist.
I'll do it with another guy.
No, do you want to do another one? Good one, man.
Good.
I got to run. I'll see you later.
Where are you going?
I got to go.
The change
good.
That occurred in just one night. Guest contributor Mick Elmes becoming a journalist in front of our very, very ears, I guess. Mick Elmes is now a journalist from Darlinghurst with that story on change in Sydney. That piece and the one previous were both produced by Mike Williams. You are listening to FBI 94.5. All the Best is the name of this program. Each week on our show, we take a theme and explore it through the people and the places of Sydney. Today's theme is change, and throughout the program we've been asking you, what do you think needs to change in Sydney? I've got a couple of messages. I think the transport system needs an upheaval. 24-hour travel. I want to be able to catch a train home after midweek drinks, not get stuck in some strange area and have to spend half my pay on a cab. That was texted in on 0409 945 945 if you want to let us know what you think needs to change in Sydney. We've got another one from Chris. Ironically, I'm using this lovely Saturday morning writing an essay about educational change. When immersed in change, new ideas and creativity are bound to come. A localised approach to education in Sydney schools will bring positive ideas to Sydney. Educators must learn to subvert the neoliberal agendas of politicians if they are to facilitate change and new ideas in this beautiful city. Chris, I reckon you're going to go pretty well in your essay. Let us know what you think needs to change in Sydney. You can do it by contacting us over Twitter, underscore all the best, or FBI Radio, both on your Twitter streams, or 0409 945 945 if you'd like to send us a text. We are exploring the theme of change. Still to come, we catch up with Red Riders on the eve of them hanging up their guitars and calling it a day, and find out what it's like to have your life change in an instant. Going to take a track now from Tupac. A bit of a warning on this. There are some strong themes in it. This one, it's called Changes.
Gotta make that change. Changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snap.
Now, we are exploring the theme of change this morning on All the Best. We've been asking you what you think needs to change in Sydney. Got a couple more messages in. Car drivers' attitudes towards bike riders need to change. So much car rage against bikes seems really strange. That's from Meg. She tweeted at us. You can do the same, or you can text us on 0409 945 945. What do you think needs to change in this city? We've got another one in from Hayley in Newtown. We need more live music venues. So many have closed lately. More are popping up, but we need more. Need more. A lot of emphasis on the needing more of live music venues. Hayley, I could not agree more. 0409 945 945 to let us know what you think needs to change in this city.
Stories from Sydney on FBI.
Now, change can happen slowly over a lifetime, or it can happen in just one day. Gary Fulcher was a healthy, fit and active clinical psychologist until a car accident left third-degree burns on 60% of his body. There was a lot of physical change, but the psychological change was just as great.
I have insulin-dependent diabetes, and I was moving from one work site to another, and my blood sugars dropped. I realised that I pulled over off to the side of the road, but I didn't get there. I passed out. A fire started under the car while I was unconscious, and the fire got in through the gear well. And then once the flames were inside the car, it then fed itself off the vinyl and plastic, and being fed by the air conditioning that was on. It was a December, so it was a hot day, and I woke up on fire. Before my accident, I had a very active life. I was involved in a range of activities, and actually one of the challenges to me was how much my physical changes stopped me from being able to do anything that I wanted to, which is pretty much what I was doing prior to the accident. So the injuries and the disabilities that I ended up with, severely curtailed what I was able to achieve. People that are significantly burned often don't survive, and systemic problems can occur at any stage. And I knew that I could just die. I wondered if I should. That was an interesting process. And as a clinical psychologist, I was able to reflect on what I was doing. And I realised that if I was actually thinking about living or dying, I'd already made up my mind, so I might as well just get on with it. But being a clinical psychologist gave me skills to be able to handle it. It enabled me to be able to treat my own trauma, because in the intensive care unit, I diagnosed myself as having acute stress disorder. But I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, I couldn't speak, and I couldn't do therapy with anyone in the room but the guy in bed with me. I realised that I had to treat myself. I can't say goodbye. After the accident, my first experience of what I looked like only occurred once I could get out of bed. I very much wanted to have a look at me. It was a pretty frightening experience. I looked pretty horrific. What I saw was the scars, the burns, the disfigurement. That was the first impact, the first, you know, bang. That was actually followed, interestingly, by the realisation that it's just the same bloke, but now singed and crispy. That was quite comforting. But at the same time, the realisation that I've got to take this out into the world was pretty confronting. My first trip out of the burns unit, my wife wheeled me in a wheelchair and we were going down in the lift. And the doors opened and there was a mother and two children. And she went and pulled her children back at the sight of me. So my idea that I might have difficulty taking this damaged body out into the world was very quickly confirmed, and that was very confronting. Before the burn, I was very fit. I played lots of sport and enjoyed physical activity and really enjoyed being able to burn off the, you know, stress and worries of the day physically. Since the burn, I am enormously limited in what I can do in terms of exercise. So exercise is difficult for me, and the loss of ability just to go and run has been difficult to cope with. Now I have to go and kind of meditate. Now, I'm okay at that and I'm quite good at de-stressing myself, but it's a very different way of doing it, and I miss the physicality, the vitality of that. My injuries have affected my personal life in negatively by limiting what I can do, but it's also affected me in many positive ways. I'm a lot more patient now than I used to be. You know, no matter how bad things are, they're only going to be that bad for a short period of time. And anyone can cope with virtually anything for the 60 seconds that is all you have to cope with it, because after you've coped with it for that 60 seconds, sure, there's another 60 seconds, but you've just proved you can cope with this 60 seconds, so the next 60 seconds is quite manageable. And also, I've realised just how good life is. I'm very, very lucky. I have a really good life, and I would prefer to have 10 fingers, and I'd definitely prefer not to have grafted skin, but I've got those, but they come with a very good life. They're just nights and days
that we while away. Gary Fulcher, speaking some very wise words with producer Liam Neerham. If you've just joined us, we are exploring the theme of change this morning on All the Best. You can find all these stories and the ones to come up on the website fbiradio.com. Following the show, we'll be podcasting it along with all of our programs, fbiradio.com, to hear more All the Best. Still to come, we will be catching up with Red Riders ahead of their very last show. As well as that, we'll be jumping back in time to 2003 when their very, very, very first radio interview. LCD Sound System with I Can Change. You're listening to All the Best, where this morning we are exploring that theme, change. We've been asking you, how do you think Sydney needs to change? Got a couple more messages in. Better infrastructure for public transport, rubbish and recycling bins on train station platforms, and more support for artists from Sarah. A kind of like vaguely similar one as well. Jillo wrote, If we can change transport and get cheaper rent, the arts will naturally thrive as a result. I like that idea. I like that idea and hope someone who has some impact on these things is listening, or perhaps we can get in touch. Let them know how you think Sydney can change. Let us know, 0409 945 945, or send us a tweet. Now, you are listening to All the Best, and our next story comes on the back of many a sad indie faces. Recently, Sydney staples Red Riders announced they were calling it a day. Over the band's 8 years, they've seen a lot of change, a swag of new venues, music scenes, and a couple of new band members. Next week, they'll play their last show in Sydney ever. Mike Williams caught up with Al Grigg from the band to have a nice big reminisce. He took along with him the first ever Red Riders radio interview, produced by Julia Thomas in 2003.
I am Superman.
We are still working on it, you know. This is pre-Red Riders. This is a band called Starch that me and Adrian had.
So that's the music they made. But how did Adrian and Matt meet to begin with? And how did they find themselves back in a band together after 7 years on opposite sides of the Tasman?
Well, you know, we were 14. You know, we'd sort of gotten into records and stuff and sort of playing guitars and trying to learn to write songs. And then I met Al, who is Mr. Alex Grigg, my co-singer, songwriter, guitarist.
We were at Black Rebel Motorcycle Club concert.
And we sort of started writing songs together just here in my flat and just jamming the two of us and getting a bit of a back catalogue together.
And it was a good concert as well. It was noisy and loud and messy, and that's kind of what we've always liked about rock and roll.
The audio you're listening to was from an interview by Julia Thomas with the Red Riders in 2003. 2003, Red Riders had only played a couple of gigs and FBI was just about to become a certified radio station. 8 years on, I feel like I'm completing a circle. I'm meeting with Al Grigg from the band in a shop he works at on King Street. I started by playing him that interview.
But yeah, man, I don't know.
How do you feel? How does it make you feel listening to that?
It's really nice and nostalgic for, you know, a time in my life where we were just so excited and it felt like everything was kind of possible.
I'm so super, I'm Superman.
The band started in about 2003. I was really desperate to start a band and was really good friends with Shag. He was going to art school with Adrian, and then Adrian saw me at a Black Rebel Motorcycle gig and recognised me from this art video that Shag had made. Adrian was like,
hey, you know, nice haircut, let's form a band.
Matt, who is from New Zealand and had come over on exchange when he was about 14 or 15, moved to Australia because his girlfriend joined the Israeli army. This is years later when he was about 18 or something. Tom Wallace, the drummer, was at art school as well with Adrian. Through that art school connection, kind of got roped in. By the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, it seemed like all of the venues were kind of shutting down and there wasn't really a scene in Sydney. And, you know, everyone was sort of bemoaning the death of live music here. So when we started up, it really literally felt, at least, that it was just like us, you know, Dappled Cities and Faker. I mean, that was like, that is just how it felt, I guess. Spectrum wasn't open yet. Oxford Art Factory didn't exist. You know, County's Apartment wasn't doing shows, World Bar, any of these places, you know, like we started at a time when there wasn't really anything. And then we've seen the scene kind of grow and then kind of maybe reach that, I mean, of a like peak or whatever, maybe around 2006. When we started, I remember being on these bills of bands that were so really dissimilar, but were just bands. So we all played together and it became the scene or whatever. Whereas now I feel like it's a lot more disparate, but at the same time, all of those scenes sort of have almost like their own scenes. Now there's a definite like DIY scene that someone like Kiosk would have been playing at you know, if that scene had existed instead of being on the same bill as, you know, us. Tell me about the summer of 2006. It was a really good time in Sydney for live music. Like, lots of venues were kind of opening up. Existing venues were putting on live bands. Indie music, and especially kind of danceable indie rock or whatever, was kind of like the flavour of the month. So it was kind of conducive to going out and having a good time and partying. And I was a fool to let you go. Yeah, I was a fool, I don't want you to know. Every time that I see your face, it feels like love. Red Riders were getting pretty big. They were getting heaps of airplay on the radio, and they signed to Ivy League Records. But things started to change within the band. Small things, like the record label questioning where each band member stood. They wanted Alex to stand in the middle of the stage like a frontman, something the band had never done before. Later it became obvious that Alex and Adrian's songwriting were going in very different directions. In 2008, founding member and co-songwriter Adrian left the band. He kind of put the ultimatum to us. It was like, well, you've either got to play these songs or I'm leaving. And we were like, well, we don't want to play those songs. And he just left. It's kind of funny, like, you're kind of sad, but you're also kind of like a little bit pissed off, because it's like, well, there's this kind of unspoken pact with a band or something that you're kind of all in this thing together. And, you know, you'd like to think that people can put their sort of egos aside, because, you know, we were always really good friends and, like, yeah, and we never really had a bad falling out even over this. It was just like, it is kind of understandable that if, you know, he didn't want to be in a band and just be a guitarist.
About a year ago, Matt, the original bass player, left to focus on his career.
He was doing his Masters of Business and sort of trying to go down that path. And so he left, and then Tom and I kind of like sort of carried on, and Brad, who plays in the Vines and replaced Adrian, he was getting busy with the Vines again. The Vines were putting out a record, so it kind of just ended up me and Tom. And then, we were going to kind of keep going with this thing. It just really changed the dynamic and the spirit of it. And so Tom and I were like, well, let's just call it a day and, like, leave before we ruin it or something, or we cheapen this thing that we've made that we're really proud of.
It's not too sad. Next week, Red Riders have huge send-off gigs in Sydney and Melbourne. Alex is also excited about a new band he's starting. A band, he tells me, that's quite different to the messy and loud Black Rebel Motorcycle gig where he and Adrian met all those years ago.
It's just way more like melodic and simple and not so like intense or not so like melodramatic or something. At the moment, I just like hate like epic music, you know. I feel like there's so much music at the moment that's just like trying to be so universal, and I just don't, it doesn't interest me anymore, you know. And I just want to make like simple music that reflects like my like simple life, you know. And maybe that's something that comes as you become more comfortable with yourself as well, and not really concerned about, you know, like a scene or people around you. And it's just like you just make the music that you want to make, and doesn't really matter, like nothing else really matters, I guess.
Al Grieg, from a band soon to be remembered as Red Riders. That story was produced by Mike Williams. And a special thanks to Julia Thomas for digging an interview with Red Riders out of the vault from 2003. Red Riders play a sold-out show at the Oxford Art Factory next Saturday night. That is it for today's show. Thanks so much for tuning in and for sending in your tips on how Sydney should change. We've got one last vote in from Meg. She says cheaper rent in a year when she moves to Sydney for radio. Meg, I hope for your sake that's what happens. Thanks also to our guests on the program and to Nick Hadlin, Zasha Rosen, Mike Williams and Liam Neerham for our stories today. A special thanks to Mick Elmes for his very first story recorded last night on Oxford Street. The program was produced by Alex Story. All the Best is produced by myself and Jesse Cox and executive producer Bridget Dagg. Join us next week as we get out of the studio and bring you stories recorded live in a library. It's more exciting than it sounds, I promise. We'll bring you tales from a Japanese manga library, from the home of Gertrude Stein's manuscripts, and the secret thievery that occurred in Dural Library some decades ago. Kate Jinks is on your radio in just a moment with Too Much, talking movies at the best time to talk movies in this city during the Sydney Film Festival, featuring interviews with some of the best tellers of stories via film, including Joshua Marston, Alexander Zeldovich, and Miranda July. Keep listening to get us there. We'll leave you with one of the strongest songs about change, originally penned in 1963 by Sam Cooke and covered about a billion times since. This song was the virtual anthem of the civil rights movement in the States and was written as a response to Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind. Here is A Change Is Gonna Come. Thanks so much for listening as we explored the theme of change. We'll see you next week.
It's been a long time coming, but I know